You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, is time on our side? Our next guest explores the science of time.
First, police across the nation and here in Wisconsin are under close scrutiny, especially in the wake of high-profile shootings of African Americans by police. It's in this tense environment that Madison's 23 police recruits are entering the profession.
So what's in store for these future cops and the communities they serve? In an effort to find out, WPR News has been following the class through the training academy. As the academy comes to a close, they're one step closer to becoming full officers. Bridget Bowden tells us what's next for the recruits.
On the first day of the training academy back in September, Lieutenant Marianne Flynn Stotts described the environment that the new recruits would be entering.
As you know, you're coming into a profession that is under fire like it never has been at any other time. And here at Madison, we're incredibly proud of how we train.
Now, almost 6 months later, recruit Lijaya Miles says she can't believe she made it through the academy.
I've learned that I can mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, how far I can stretch myself. Like, I had no idea starting out what a journey this would be.
Miles has wanted to be a police officer since she was 8 years old. But even still, she says going through the academy actually improved her perception of police.
I definitely have more respect for officers. It's not just like, you know, cops and robbers. It's so much more than I've ever imagined it could be. I got into this because I wanted to be a partner with the community.
Recruit Claire Glady grew up in a Madison police family. Her dad just retired as a captain. She says going through training has given her a new outlook on controversial topics like the use of force.
It's a different perspective when you're in the uniform and you're dealing with the unknown every day. So that training has opened my eyes to a better understanding of use of force, but I think I agree with a lot of other people that police need to be held to a high standard.
Now, as the recruits leave the academy, they're headed into 3 months of field training. Glady says she feels prepared and a little nervous.
The first day, you know, it's going to be, you're going on the streets, you're a police officer, so people are going to look at you different, so I think that's going to be another thing, just get used to another factor. You're not seen as the person, you're seen as the uniforms.
Field training is like a residency for police officers. The recruits start out mostly observing their trainers. By the end of 3 months, these roles flip and the recruits become the primary officers. On the last day of the academy, Chief of Police Mike Koval tells the recruits about his own experience in field training, including a story about one particularly strict training officer.
If I put my big toe out of the car door without turning on my portable radio first, he failed me for the day for officer safety.
But he says that's part of the process. The recruits will be constantly graded throughout field training.
I realized that he was telling me profoundly that that's your umbilical life cord. Don't get out of the car without turning on that portable radio. And you know what? If you're anything like me, I'm actually saying that I learned more from my mistakes than from my victories.
The class started off with 23 recruits, and all of them have successfully completed the academy. There's a chance, though, that they won't all make it through field training. As he leaves the training center, Chief Koval wishes the class good luck.
Lieutenant, they look like they're ready to go, and they're chomping at the bit, and the old man has talked too long. So thank you, guys, and I'm looking forward to seeing those reports out in the street.
Recruits who successfully complete field training will graduate in June. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For the rest of our Police Academy series, visit WPR.org/Police Academy.
And Bridget Bowden joins us now in the studio to talk about what she's learned from this project. She's a special projects reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. And Bridget, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
So going into this project, what were you expecting? Did you have any things that you were hoping would happen or hoping wouldn't happen?
Right. So I knew very little about policing before I started this project. I don't have any police officers in my family or my friends. So most of my expectations had come from things I had seen in movies. So as far as the police academy, I was expecting, you know, lots of shooting and obstacle courses and lots of physical training. So that's kind of what I was expecting. And of course, there was a little bit of that, but there was quite a bit more as well.
And What did you learn about the people that are drawn to becoming police officers in the time that you spent with these recruits and really got to know them?
Mm-hmm. It is very heavy on all of the recruits' minds that this is a time that's difficult for police officers for many different reasons. All of them are very enthusiastic about the profession and very excited to get out on the streets. I learned a lot about the kinds of training that the Madison Police Department does as well. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I was sort of expecting lots of physical training. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a lot of time spent sitting in the classroom learning about law and learning about different cultures. They do a whole lecture on Hmong culture and a whole day of training on Latino culture. They also spend a bunch of time practicing professional communication skills, which is, you know, how to be polite and how mm-hmm. to de-escalate situations using just words. So there was really a lot of training that was not just jumping hurdles mm-hmm. and shooting guns.
And how much did you learn about how the recruits interact with other current officers? I mean, they're learning all this kind of in a classroom setting or maybe in a gym setting. But how much are they able to tap into the experience and the wisdom of people who have been on the force for a long time?
Mm-hmm. Before the recruits even start the academy, they are assigned a mentor from the department, so someone who's a veteran officer. So they have that contact throughout the whole academy process. If they have questions of a veteran officer or if they want to practice things or maybe someone to quiz them on things they're studying. But then also they, throughout the academy process, they go on ride-alongs mm-hmm. and they interact quite a bit with more veteran officers. And also training officers are people who have been patrol officers and in some cases more specialized positions.
Mm-hmm. And in talking with both veteran officers and training officers, but also these recruits, did you get a sense of things that people in law enforcement wish that the public knew about that would help kind of improve those relationships between the communities and the law enforcement?
Sure. So I can only really speak to the Madison Police Department, mm-hmm. of course. We know that there are lots of police departments, even just in Dane County. But as far as the officers and future officers that I met, I think that they would hope that the public would understand that police do more than what you see in the movies, for example. Even the training that I saw was more than just, you know, your police academy movies. It mm-hmm. was a lot of time spent in the classroom, a lot of time reading books.
Mm-hmm. And as we wrap up, Bridget, you were there as a journalist, but you were, you know, part of the class in many ways. What would you say was the biggest takeaway for you as a journalist or just as a person from going through this training?
I definitely learned a lot, and I did in some cases even participate in the training. At the beginning of the 6 months, we did a ropes course, and, you know, I climbed everything and jumped off everything with the class. So I really learned a lot, but I think that my biggest takeaway is that policing in the modern era is such a complicated issue, and there's so many different sides of it. And I learned that there's really a lot that the police still have to learn about the community, but there's also still a lot that the community has to learn about the police.
Well, Bridget, thanks so much for joining us today and for bringing us all of these really interesting features over the past several months.
Thank you so much.
That was Bridget Bowden, WPR Special Projects Reporter. She joined us to talk about the final installation of her year-long series following recruits in the Madison Police Academy. You can find the whole series at WPR.org/Police Academy.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Republicans on Capitol Hill have released their replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act. We'll learn what their new plan does and what it could mean for programs like Medicaid moving forward.
First, we live our life by clocks and alarms and deadlines. but most of us don't really understand how time works. Sometimes a minute feels like an hour, and other moments, hours fly by in what feels like seconds.
Our next guest set out to understand time as it functions in his own life as the father of twin boys and from a scientific perspective.
Alan Burdick joins us now. He's a staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker. He's the author of the book Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, how did you first get interested in figuring out exactly what's going on with time?
Well, a couple of things. My last book was about evolution and ecology, and it got me kind of thinking about these vast time scales of tens of thousands, millions of years, and the difficulty with just how hard it is to think of those scales because we, you know, live in a 90-year, 100-year window. And so it got me thinking about what time is really, not out there in a space-time kind of way, but in here, in us. And also, you know, like a lot of people, I had what I would call an antagonistic relationship to time. and I thought maybe if I studied, if I studied it, I might get better at it.
In a way, was it kind of hard to separate out what time is scientifically? Because for the most part, it's the water that we swim in, and it seems like it's possible to stop noticing, at least maybe until we have kids or something like that.
Well, in a way, yeah. I mean, time. We talk about time all the time, but in terms of the perception of time, we're actually perceiving a number of different things. Time is an array of perceptions, from our understanding that the past is different from the present and the future, to understanding what's called temporal order, the order in which things happen, to understanding duration, my ability to tell that 3 seconds is longer than 2 seconds without even counting it. These are all really distinct psychological phenomena, and they come online as we grow into them. You might have a 2-year-old kid who can speak perfectly well in the past and the present tense, but doesn't know the difference between before and after until they're 3 or even 4 years old.
So in that sense, did you find out that time is not necessarily that, I guess, feels like a biological imperative? It is because our bodies age, but do our minds have to catch up to that understanding of time that you're describing?
Well, I kind of began to think of time, at least in the psychological sense. I mean, we do really have kind of time hardwired into our cells. But the kind of psychological time that we experience, I began to think of as almost like a language that we really need in order to socialize with one another at all these different levels. And kind of like a language, it doesn't really exist. The perception of time doesn't really exist without us to perceive it. It's not an illusion, but we need it.
From a philosophical viewpoint, going in, what were the big questions you wanted to answer about time?
Well, I mean, I guess I wanted to know. I started out wanting to know what is it, and that was really the first question that I kind of posed to the psychologists and neuroscientists that I talked to, and they would all turn it around on me and say, "Well, what do you mean by time?" and then they parsed it out in all of these different ways. And as I kind of got deeper and deeper into these rabbit holes, I began to wonder about, like, what exactly is the present that we experience, the now, and how long is now exactly? When you start diving into the literature on time, you can really fall down some very deep holes.
So yeah, that question of now, because that's something we get hit over the head with quite a lot. We always hear how it's desirable to live in the now. The only moment of your life you can actually experience is now, but that now can sometimes feel kind of elusive. So what did you find out about what now is?
Well, I mean, and again, it's probably important to say we're not talking about, physics or space-time, but what, the perceptual now, the perceived now. And there was a time at the end of the 19th century when, a group of psychologists was really actively involved in trying to measure how long now is in all these very kind of picayune ways. But William James kind of came along and said, look, let's just say that the present isn't some point in time. It's what he's going to call the specious present. And it's, you know, maybe a second long. It's kind of long enough to contain, you know, a thought and its very short tail. You know, it's enough to notice that there's a sparrow flying across the yard. The way you define the present is almost like the basic unit of psychological awareness, the basic unit of consciousness, in effect.
Well, what if you're a physicist and you approach it from that point of view? Then what do you say if I ask you, what is time?
Well, I mean, again, that's really not something that I dived into for these purposes, because, you know, I felt like that has been pretty well discussed in ways that I still barely understand and that most of us have a hard time wrapping our minds around. But, you know, when we talk about time in us, we're talking about the perception of time, and we're talking about ultimately perception. You know, we're talking about the act of perception and how that works.
We're talking with Alan Burdick right now, staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker, and he's the author of Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. And you wanted to see what it was like to kind of lose your sense of time, and you went to the Arctic during the summer when there is no real night. What did that end up being like?
That was pretty wild. I mean, the reason I did that is because there's a very long established literature on the biology of time, and in our bodies, in our cells, in our organs, we have basically these 24-hour clocks that tick out a very regular rhythm that kind of run our physiology. And there have been all these interesting experiments done, sending people into caves for weeks at a time to see how they respond to, you know, how do they perform in the absence of light. And I wanted to see what that was like, except I didn't really want to go to a cave. I wanted to go into constant daylight. And it was really surreal. You know, I'm accustomed to, you know, going to bed when it's dark and waking up when it's just getting light. But up there, you know, you go to bed when it's totally bright outside, and you wake up when it's totally bright outside, and it begins to feel like one very long, endless day in a way that's both wonderful and utterly disorienting.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I mean, did being a little unmoored, untethered from time as we know it, did it feel liberating, or did it feel like a curse? Maybe you needed time more than you thought.
Yeah, I did need time more than I thought. I mean, I was with a group of biologists in a camp that they have up there. There's like 100 of them. And people kind of fell into two categories. There were people who ignored their watches and they stayed awake as long as they wanted to, and they slept as long as they wanted to, and they worked and ate whenever they wanted to. And then there were people like me who felt like, I need some kind of a regular rhythm to my day, and I'm going to go to bed at 10, you know, when my watch says 10 o'clock, even though all the visual cues suggest otherwise. And I needed something to hang on to.
And you also wanted to check out kind of what happens in extreme situations. We hear about if you're in an impending car crash, that time can slow down and these seconds can really drag before the moment of impact. How did you check out that angle?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to investigate, obviously, because you don't want to put people in truly life-threatening situations. But maybe the closest we've come is a study that a neuroscientist named David Eagleman did a few years ago, in which he had subjects, it took them to a kind of an extreme amusement park and had them free fall from the top of a 100-foot tower into a net, and he'd set up a kind of a special chronometer on them to see, you know, if their sense of time slowed down during this stressful process. And I actually took part in it to see what it was like, and it really was kind of terrifying. and I, you know, I can say that time kind of did slow down a little bit. But, you know, what we kind of think is happening in those moments is that in moments of stress, memories are getting laid down basically in thicker layers and higher resolution. And in the moments afterward, the brain translates that extra resolution into more duration, into a moment seeming to take longer.
Oh, that's interesting. So you have, do you feel this in yourself, that you have this moment that's sort of seared into there about when you're dropping down to this net?
Well, in a funny way, it happens so quickly that it was almost, you know, by the time that I realized that I was in free fall, it was essentially over. Because that's part of it too, is that our, you know, our conscious awareness of right now actually trails the physical experience by about a tenth of a second. And so, you know, what we think of as right now is a little bit behind the times.
And you also went into this as a new parent with twin boys, and flash forward 10 years later, you finished your book and your children are 10 years old. Did you get a sense on that kind of time, both for children and for yourself, and that sense of time speeding up for some people and slowing down for others?
Yeah, in a funny way, it's kind of a, I mean, for all the science that's in it, it's kind of a coming-of-age story in that, you know, I'm becoming a parent, I'm learning what it means to take on that responsibility, and I'm also watching my kids grow into, you know, the adult world of time, which is all these things, from knowing, you know, what it means when you say 8 o'clock on a clock, to knowing what, you know, we're going to leave 5 minutes from now means, to, you know, getting them to understand that we're going to do this, and then after that this, and then this, and then this. And you know, those are conversations that I was having all the time with my kids without even thinking about it. And that became kind of the lens through which I started to see, you know, everything that I was reading about.
And Ellen, as we wrap up, there's a lot of literature, there's songs considering whether or not time is this cruel taskmaster that devours our lives, or whether it's an angle or like an angel that lets us get some distance from the things that hurt us. Where do you come down on that now?
I mean, I think it's both a curse and a blessing. You know, the curse is that there's not enough of it. But the blessing is that, you know, that we have it at all. and it, you know, it is integral to our lives as a social species. We couldn't be social without it.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Alan Burdick, staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker, and he's the author of the new book, Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation.
Coming up, we'll learn about the GOP's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. Tonight, Latino USA looks at the long-standing relationship between Hollywood, Latin America, and Latino filmmakers. We find out how Hollywood movies are adapted for Latin American audiences by learning about the dubbing of the most recent Star Wars film, Rogue One. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, Republicans on Capitol Hill unveiled their long-awaited health care plan that would replace and repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The signature initiative under the Obama administration has been challenged many times by Republicans in Congress and even in the nation's highest court.
Donna Friedsam is with us now to talk about the GOP's health care plan. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be with you.
So on first read, what is your sense of how big a departure the new Republican plan called the American Health Care Act is from former President Obama's signature piece of legislation, the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it really depends on your perspective, because this the bill that was released yesterday seems to be getting criticism from the conservative side of the GOP in saying that it's not enough of a departure from the Affordable Care Act. But then from the Democratic side and from the liberal perspective, there's quite a bit of concern about how much of a departure it is from the existing amount of support there is for low-income people. So I think there is no definitive answer because there's a wide variety of perspectives out there.
In general, did Republicans deliver on what they promised in this new piece of proposed legislation?
Well, it certainly isn't a wholesale overhaul in terms of scrapping the Affordable Care Act and throwing everything away and starting from scratch. There are a number of provisions of the Affordable Care Act that remain in the bill that is that was released yesterday, and several things that the Affordable Care Act put into place that this bill contemplates continuing. So if the people were looking for going back to where we were in 2009, prior to the Affordable Care Act ever existing, then no, this bill does not accomplish that. On the other hand, it does include some substantial changes to Medicaid and to subsidies for lower-income people in terms of how they purchase coverage that do depart from the way the Affordable Care Act functions. So it does substantially change what exists today. But I would not call it a dramatic change from the Affordable Care Act. I would call it a different way of approaching coverage, but certainly not a wholesale replacement of what we have.
Well, in public opinion of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare has gone up in recent weeks, and there's also been polls showing that some people don't know that Obamacare is the same thing as the Affordable Care Act, so there's been some confusion on that front as well. But do you think that's part of why perhaps the changes are not as dramatic as maybe especially some Republicans might hope?
That may be. A number of the provisions that remain in this bill reflect what has always been popular with the Affordable Care Act, and that those are things around allowing our younger members, dependents up to age 26, to remain on their parents' policy, or assuring that people for the most part, can't be excluded for coverage due to pre-existing conditions. But I would say that the things that are in this bill now that are not major departures from Obamacare are more likely to be structured the way they are now because of a difficulty in achieving consensus among the Republican caucus about what repeal and replacement bills should look like. So they're trying to bring about some agreement across a broad range of perspectives, even within the Republican leadership and across Republican governors, who all have different perspectives and different investments in how this bill needs to look. So I don't think it's only a result of the change among the kind of public polling that has resulted in the bill that we're seeing today.
Well, you mentioned a couple of popular provisions from the Affordable Care Act that seem to be staying. There are things that change, though, and one of these is the removal of the individual mandate. Tell us about the status of that particular aspect.
Right. So the individual mandate was probably the least popular or most unpopular part of the of Obamacare. And I will, by the way, use the words Affordable Care Act and Obamacare interchangeably with no value judgment attached to either one of those terms. But and ACA as well. So Obamacare did have this individual mandate requiring people to, for the most part, get health insurance coverage if they had access to some kind of affordable coverage. There were, by the way, a number of exceptions to that, and people could apply for exemptions to that mandate. But nonetheless, that mandate existed. Why did that mandate exist? Because Obamacare told insurance companies that they needed to accept all people, regardless of whether people had pre-existing conditions or what their health status was when they entered into coverage. So in order for health insurance companies to be able to take people that had compromised health status or were bringing to them significant health problems, we needed somehow to assure in this country that the health, the overall pool of insured people included some healthy people. That's how insurance works, by sharing risk between healthier people and people who need some kind of care. And so otherwise, I make the analogy that homeowners all have to have insurance on their homes. Even when their homes are standing and are structurally sound, we all need to insure our homes in the event that something happens. If we did not need to insure our homes, then none of us would insure our homes until the day that our homes were on fire, and then we would stand out on the street watching our homes burn, and we would call the insurance company at that moment and try to purchase insurance. Well, that may be good for us as consumers, but there'd be no insurance companies in the world that would be in that line of business because they would have no ability to offer that product. Same with health insurance. The mandate existed in order to make sure that there were some, that there were plenty of people paying in premiums to allow the companies to pay out premiums for people in need. So people didn't like, though, being told that they had to buy insurance. So the Republican plan says we're not going to mandate people to buy insurance, and it puts in a different mechanism that is that calls for continuous coverage, and I'm happy to explain that if you like.
Right, so is that the mechanism in the new plan that would take the place of that individual mandate, bringing down premiums, for instance? How would that work?
It essentially says that people need to maintain continuous coverage in their health insurance, and if they don't, they could be subject to a penalty when they try to purchase insurance. So if people are out of the health insurance market for a certain number of days, then, and I believe the number is 63 days, then so basically 2 months, then when they go back to purchase insurance, they no longer get the benefit of what we call community rating, but instead they could be subject to some penalties up to 30% of the cost of insurance. So they no longer get the benefit of not being penalized for pre-existing conditions and the like, and instead they would have to pay higher premiums when they come back in. So, and however, even with that provision, the penalty of 30% would only be in place for 12 months, and then they could go back to the regular rate that everybody else enjoys. Nonetheless, that provision around the continuous coverage is intended to try to provide people an incentive to maintain their coverage and not stay out, not remain uninsured, and only buy insurance when they get sick.
We're talking with Donna Friedsam right now from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, looking at the American Health Care Act, which is the GOP's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. And Donna, I want to ask you about the tax credits. That's another pretty significant departure from the Affordable Care Act. How would tax credits be used to help pay for this insurance under the new Republican plan?
Right. Now, this is probably one of the most significant departures from the existing Affordable Care Act, this and the way Medicaid is structured. So people are going to really want to pay close attention to this. Under the existing Affordable Care Act, there are premium tax credits that help subsidize the cost of health insurance. So, and those tax credits are based on income. And they're available to people up to four times the federal poverty level. So for an individual, and I'm talking about today under the Affordable Care Act or under Obamacare, people who, an individual who up to an income of about $48,000, $49,000 a year can get a tax credit. And it's a sliding fee scale. So people at very, very low incomes would get more of a tax credit than people that were up, that were closer to that $48,000 cutoff. And similarly, a family of four, the four times the federal poverty level is about $98,000 a year. So if a family of four makes $40,000 a year, they're going to get a larger tax credit for purchasing insurance than a family that makes $90,000 a year. And ultimately, a family that makes more than that $98,000 cutoff won't get any subsidy at all. That's how the ACA works today. The GOP plan that was released yesterday changes that model quite significantly. It no longer bases the tax subsidies on income at all, and instead bases it on age. So people who are older would get a larger subsidy than people that are younger. And with the idea that older people have larger insurance premiums than younger people, so the intent there is to help older people buy insurance. But it but nonetheless, it doesn't also link it to whether people are lower income versus higher income. However, there is a cap such that individuals with incomes above $75,000 a year would not receive that tax subsidy, and households with incomes above $150,000 a year would not receive that subsidy. So this is getting a little complex, but there's a couple of things to notice. Everybody gets exactly the same subsidy. It doesn't matter whether you are, if you're a 25-year-old individual, you get the same subsidy whether your income is $20,000 or your income is $70,000. It doesn't change at all. It's not based on income. It's only based on age. And similarly, if you are a 50-year-old, you will get the exact same subsidy if you make $20,000 a year and you make $70,000 a year. It makes no difference. So it's really just based on age. As well, the subsidies in the GOP plan go to a lot higher income than did the ACA. So I mentioned earlier that Obamacare provides subsidies up to people at 400% of the federal poverty level. So that for an individual, that's $49,000 a year, and for a household, that's about $99,000 a year. The GOP plan provides those subsidies, the flat subsidies, not based on income, but it cuts them off to, after people make $75,000 for an individual and $150,000 for a family.
Donna Friedsam is with us right now. She's the Health Policy Programs Director and Researcher at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. And she's joining us now to talk about the American Health Care Act, which is the GOP's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your opinion on the current Affordable Care Act? Do you support the plan, or do you think that the health care reform law needs to be changed? What was your experience under the ACA? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about the American Health Care Act. That's the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And we're going through the plan right now with Donna Friedsam. She's the Health Policy Programs Director and Researcher at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Affordable Care Act as it's currently in place? Do you support Republican-led efforts to replace it? And what would you like to see in a national health care plan? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Phil on the line in Bundy. Phil, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask?
Okay, I'm a little curious as to how this new system will work. How will it work with the employers that are now getting the subsidies? Like, my employer sponsors my health care, or a portion thereof. And then the other thing I'm wondering is, like, right now, my wife and myself have different employers, and we both have to have separate insurance with separate deductibles and all that. Is there anything going to fix something like that?
Okay, Phil, thank you. A couple good questions there. And Donna, what do you say to Phil's two questions?
I didn't entirely hear his first question, but I can say this, that
subsidies to employers to help pay for employee insurance, will that change?
The GOP plan eliminates the subsidies for employers. I assume then that he's with a small employer, and the GOP, the Affordable Care Act had some subsidies for small employers to purchase insurance for their employees, and the GOP plan eliminates those subsidies. So those will no longer be available. And with regard to his second question, him and his wife having separate plans and separate deductibles, there's nothing in the GOP plan that addresses that matter.
There are getting back at subsidies and businesses. There are, Donna, some taxes, it sounds like, that are changing.
So the GOP plan eliminates most of the taxes that are well, essentially all of the taxes that are currently associated with the Affordable Care Act are phased out.
And I want to ask you, Donna, you mentioned as we went into the break there about the difference between the Affordable Care Act and the Republican plan. The Affordable Care Act had tax credits based on income. The Republican plan has them based on age. How do you think that will affect, I know we don't know all the numbers yet, but how do you project that might affect who gets coverage?
So at this, well, let me say we don't have definitive numbers, primarily because the way this normally works is that when a bill is introduced, it gets it goes through a process called scoring by the Congressional Budget Office, but the GOP has decided to fast track this bill, so it's not going through hearings and committees, and instead it's going to directly to vote. I believe they're going to try to put it to vote tomorrow. It's not going to undergo hearings, and they're not waiting for the Congressional Budget Office to score it. So we don't have any figures around what the ultimate budgetary impact of this bill will be on the federal budget, and nor do we have any figures about what the Congressional Budget Office assesses around the impact on the number of people that will be insured or who might lose insurance under this bill. Now, the Congressional Budget Office is the nonpartisan scoring entity for Congress, and that is supposed to be used for the Congress when it makes its decisions. We won't have those numbers. So all I can go on at this point in this early period of just having seen the bill within the last 24 hours is what various writers and different think tanks are doing in terms of their projections. And what I can say to you is that all across the board, from both the left and the right, it appears that this will have the effect of a couple of effects. One is very likely that that people will lose access to their insurance in some number, but we don't know how many. So we know that the subsidies will not be as available for lower income people, and it will make it will provide more money for higher income people subsidizing their purchase, but lower income people will not have as much available to them to purchase the coverage. So it does transfer funding from lower income people to higher income people. At the same time, it does transfer some support to provide more support for older people, but it also has another effect of transferring support to younger people in trying to decrease the premiums for them. So,
and I want to jump in so we can get another caller here quickly. Kathy is with us next in Madison. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is a concern because if they do, I've been on the Affordable Care Act for 3 years. We are self-employed, husband and wife. We both have different, very, very small businesses, and we have 4 children, 2 in college and 2 and under the age of 26 and 2 at home. Our health care premium before the Affordable Care Act was twice our mortgage, our mortgage for 6 very, very healthy people with no pre-existing conditions. If they take the subsidy that was on the front end based on income and bury it in the tax code onto the back end, in other words, if they take it and put it on the back end, it will just get lost in our taxes. I am positive of that. So it's almost a trick to say, well, you just file your taxes and then you're going to get a credit. That's like the college credit, like any other credit. You have to go through 8,000 passes and line items before you actually see that help with something that the government is going to help you with.
Kathy, thank you for that comment. And Donna, we've only got about 30 seconds here. What do you think?
There is some language about having the tax credit be advanceable. The question is whether people will be able to get the tax credit at the front end when they purchase their insurance. But what this caller is going to want to look at is whether she'll be able to get the same level of subsidy under this new plan that she's been getting under the Affordable Care Act, and that will be a significant question.
Well, to be continued, it still has to go through the House and, of course, the Senate, and we'll be watching that. Donna, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Donna Friedsam joined us there to talk about the American Health Care Act, the GOP's replacement of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Donna's a researcher and the Health Policy Programs Director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.